Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, September 11th, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and Senior Fellow, Center for Civic Engagement, Bard College Ambassador Frederick Hoff.
Okay, well, so that happened last night. We spent 2 hours talking about the debate before the debate happened, and I don't think anybody on our panel, and this isn't a diss, anyone on our panel could have said that it would have gone the way it went. Now, obviously, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. However, the early polls tell us that the people who are watching the debate said that 61% believe that the Kamala Harris won the debate. And the line that we hear so often just in the last 12 hours is that how masterful she was in I just realized I shouldn't put these two words together. How good she was at baiting him, and
well played.
Yeah, thank you. of baiting him and getting him to pull whatever he was going to say aside and to move on to a different rant, for want of a better term. But although that term does seem accurate in this case. So in the moments we have here, let's just go around and for opening comments about what you made of last night and how it will shape this presidential contest over the next 8 weeks. Fred Hoff.
Well, I must say, over the first 3 to 5 minutes of this debate, my initial impression was former President Trump has this under control, and if he can keep this up, this election is decided in his favor. But he wasn't. He wasn't able to keep it up. You know, most American voters, I think, believe that President Joe Biden has failed in his stewardship of the economy and the southern border. Former President Trump's task last evening was to force Vice President Harris to own the policies and the performance of President Joe Biden, and he failed miserably. I think with discipline, with precision, Harris lured Trump away from a consistent critique of the administration's record on the economy and immigration. Trump's job was to stay relentlessly on message, even if that meant being boring for 90 minutes. All he needed to do was stay focused for 90 minutes. If he had done so, I think he would have emerged as the odds-on favorite to win in November, but he wasn't able to do so. Now, my favorite newspaper happens to be the Wall Street Journal, and I think there are words from today's lead editorial that are quite pertinent here, and I'll quote. This is Wall Street Journal. She, Vice President Harris, won the debate because she came in with a strategy to taunt and goad Mr. Trump into diving down rabbit holes of personal grievance and vanity that left her policies and history largely untouched. He always takes the debate. He always takes the bait. And Ms. Harris set the trap, so he spent much of the debate talking about the past or about Joe Biden, or about immigrants eating pets, but not how he'd improve the lives of Americans in the next 4 years. This is the Wall Street Journal, not exactly a paragon of the left in the United States.
Malia.
Well, yeah, I agree. So Trump failed at the tasks that his camp set out for him. Of course, he came out afterwards and couldn't help himself saying, "The greatest debate I ever had in my life," which he's just incapable of any kind of self-reflection or self-critique, which is, it's not surprising that the Harris debate followed up immediately by saying, "Let's have another debate."
Yeah, absolutely.
So he failed at his tasks. She had a couple tasks herself, of course, one of which she accomplished, obviously, by getting him off message, by failing to allow him to really push her on her vulnerabilities. And she does have vulnerabilities because she's still, her policies are still not understood by a lot of the electorate. Like, how is she different from Joe Biden? You know, and I think it was actually pretty, in some sense, pretty smart of her not to dive into the details of that last night. You can't accomplish everything in one 90-minute debate. What she did accomplish is to get Trump off of his message, fail to exploit her vulnerabilities. But I think a lot of undecided voters who were hoping to get a better understanding of what a Harris presidency will look like came away still not sure. And so that's probably okay for her from a campaign perspective. She's got time over the next couple months to do that, to sort of lay out policies. A debate isn't the most effective way to do that. But there are a lot of voters who, even though a debate isn't the right place to talk about the details of policy, we're still hoping to see more of that. And so I saw some New York Times analysis this morning where they talked to different undecided voters, and a lot of them were like, "Well, we still don't know." That's again not surprising. She accomplished probably the main task, which is to have a very different kind of debate than Joe Biden did. So the contrast between this one and the previous one, it couldn't be larger. So there's every reason for her camp to feel pretty happy this morning. I looked at the Washington Times, another not paragon of the left, and the way they characterized it, again, as a Harris win, and that that it was like a present that had been delivered to Donald Trump that he didn't unwrap. This present was the ability to really push her on some of the policies that are more associated with Joe Biden, and that didn't happen. He couldn't help himself.
Bob Griffin, you're good. You have full time.
Okay. Thanks. So I even want to take it from the very, very beginning. I love the way Vice President Harris came out and purposely went over and shook Trump's hand, even though he obviously
I'm Kamala Harris.
Right.
How great was that?
Obviously, he did not want anything to do with her. And we'd be remiss if we didn't just talk about some body language for a second. Throughout the entire debate, I thought it was fascinating that Trump refused to look at her. And I loved the way the vice president would either be talking to us, the people, directly, but when needed, was pivoting and talking directly to Trump. And I think that was also part of unsettling him. Fred, I agree with you. The first few minutes, I was like, oh boy. Mm-hmm. I felt it was shaky. And then we got into the question about abortion.
Yes.
And she flipped gears.
Yep.
And I thought she was spectacular. And you, as sharp as she was and cogent, he looked old. Trump looked old. He looked confused. Obviously, the Springfield that he was talking about, where supposedly immigrants are eating pets, is the Springfield from The Simpsons. So he must have been doing his debate prep, watching the Simpsons reruns. I thought that she did something that I didn't see in other debates with Trump, where she actually called out his crap and didn't let him. Bully her the way I think Clinton, we saw with Clinton, and to a large degree what we saw with Biden. I'll also say that, you know, Biden's performance was so weak that I think it hid a lot of the a lot of the poor performances from Trump in the last debate. And I again will tip my hat to the fact that I think Biden made the absolute right decision for the country by getting out. You know, when you come off stage and your people are already spinning it, saying that this was a rigged rigged deal, and that the fact that he was fact checked for, I mean, one, I think I heard one prognosticator talk about at least 33 different false claims in an hour in 42 minutes.
She had one apparently.
Yeah,
using the same.
Yeah,
she measure.
Yeah, she probably said something nice about Trump. You know, that when you're coming off and you're saying that it was rigged and that it was 3-1, you know, what's the old adage in sports? Don't put yourself in a position where the referees can actually determine the outcome. And he did. He was exhausting. It was exhausting listening to him again. And where I will continue to have cognitive disconnect is, how can 75% of this country not be supporting Harris? When I look at Trump and I listen to Trump, you know, what was her quote about hard time connecting with reality? How could you trust this man with the button to the nuclear weapons?
There were moments of just like ranting, and
Festivus poll of complaints.
Yes,
poor spoiled rich guy.
To your point of calling him on his crap, I thought Van Jones on CNN last night said people have wanted to see somebody put this bully in his place for a really long time, and they got it tonight. And that seemed accurate to me, Fred.
Yeah, I just like to pick up on Bob's point about you know, why is it so many Americans support this guy? And as I was watching the debate last night, I was, you know, reflecting on the fact that in 2016, Donald Trump got 46% of the vote. 2020, he got 47%. Current polls, obviously before the debate, suggest something on the order of 48%. This is something we really need to understand. If we're facing a crisis in this country, it's not Donald Trump. It's not Donald Trump personally. It's why is it that nearly 50% of our co-citizens believe that he is the answer to whatever sense of grievance they have, you know, dismissing it as, oh, these people are just stupid, or, oh, they're racists. I mean, you hear this from, you know, from the left all the time. That is definitely the wrong medicine for addressing this. Somehow, we need to understand why so many of our fellow citizens want to go down this path. As far as the you know, the ABC handling of the debate, I thought it was pretty decent. I would have liked to have seen more fact checking of the vice president. The one thing she said last night that I found offensive was her claim that uniformed American military personnel are not in harm's way anymore. You know, tell that to the families of American servicemen killed not all that long ago in Jordan. Tell it to the families of servicemen currently serving in Syria and Iraq and off the coast of Yemen. She's the vice president of the United States. She wants to be commander in chief. She's got to show a bit more knowledge and sensitivity about this particular issue, in my view.
Do you think, and I don't disagree with you, I'm just asking the question of, is that a poorly worded statement that it just wasn't fully thought out of the difference between us being in an active military situation versus soldiers in various places across the world.
Yeah, Joe, I can't say what accounts for it. It was not an accurate depiction of what's going on with members of the American military. If she decides at some point to take a formal press conference and really allow herself to be grilled on some specifics, I hope that question will be put to her.
Especially where I thought there was a natural pivot there to about respect for the uniform and drawing people's attention back to the events at that Arlington National, comments about the Congressional Medal of Honor. I mean, there were enough other places for her to go to deflect the constant war theme and I think that's what she was trying to do.
Yeah, it was an off moment. I'm guessing there's so many ways, of course, that Trump has insulted and been offensive about the military and tried to politicize the military. I mean, it's just it's a litany of things. So it's unfortunate that she wasn't as thoughtful as she could have been in that moment. I actually think there are. Oh, sorry, were you done?
Go ahead.
Yeah. There were two moments from last night, one of which didn't happen during the debate, that I think are going to do more to dissuade undecided voters than anything else. One is the Taylor Swift endorsement. That's like that. I mean, I feel ridiculous saying it, but you know, she does have a lot of influence over young people, and so she came out, you know, proudly signed childless cat lady for Kamala Harris, and so that was announced last night, and a lot of young people will pay attention to that. And then the other thing, during the debate, Vice President Harris mentioned that she and Tim Walz are both gun owners. And I wasn't surprised to hear that Tim Walz is a gun owner, you know, he's in Minnesota. But I didn't realize that she was as well. And so I'm sure, like, some Democrats may have, you know, cocked their eyebrow at that and be like, really? You know, why? But I think, like, that does a lot more to convince people who aren't sure where she stands. Is she really liberal or not? You know, the sort of people on the right or people in the middle who are undecided. Like, the fact that she's a gun owner, I'm just objectively speaking, my analysis is that is going to be more persuasive to people that she's not some extreme, far less liberal than Trump trying to paint her as a Marxist because her father taught economics. I mean, it shows that she can't be boxed into that far left box he's trying to put her into.
Because it was, you said the Festivus, but this airing of the litany, yeah, that he did, one of the things that he kept on saying was, they're going to come and take your guns away. They're going to come and take your guns away. They're going to come and take your guns away. And then when she turned, she said, I don't know where you're getting that. Both Tim Walz and I are gun owners.
Right.
And we're not going to do that.
People don't really, even Gabby Giffords is still a gun owner. You know, it's like, you know, there are Democrats who are for what they call responsible gun ownership. And
one comment, though, that is not, I don't think, is getting enough attention. And my wife and I were texting about it. Trump came back and he made the comment about, the reports she puts out. And that is so offensive to me. And I think it deserves more attention from the mainstream press. It's a reflection of certainly his misogyny. It's a reflection of his desperation. As you start to think about his candidacy and his potential return to office, there shouldn't be a woman out there or an ally of women out there who can support him because of that simple comment. The idea that how little esteem he holds. Vice President Harris is an amazing woman, you know, educated, professional, has an incredible career, and the idea that he would create it, the inference that she got there because of, you know, in his vernacular, putting out, is just so offensive, and it's sliding because of all the other garbage that he spewed.
That was Robert Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 11th. We'll be back with more after this break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, September 12th, Joe Donahue was joined by Publisher Emeritus of The Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
So, as mentioned, we all saw the, most of us, I think, saw the debate, and we probably all have our opinions as to what happened there. But former President Donald Trump said he had a great debate. He has been spinning aggressively his debate performance, suggesting that it was the best ever. His allies privately say otherwise. Former President Donald Trump went into a sales pitch mode immediately after Tuesday night's debate, walking into the spin room to extol his own performance, crowing on Fox News and going on late night posting spree to hype unscientific online polls that he said showed he had crushed Vice President Kamala Harris. "This was my best debate ever," shouty caps. "Especially since it was 3-on-1, shouty caps. This is a reference to the two ABC News moderators. That, of course, a posting on Truth Social. Mr. Trump was insisting the same things privately to advisors and allies in the hours after the debate, according to three people with direct knowledge who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Mr. Trump appeared jubilant, as if he truly believed that he was telling them what he was telling them. But Mr. Trump's actions after the debate told another story. In the lead up to his debate with President Biden in late June, Mr. Trump's aide suggested that he might want to go into the spin room afterward, but he rejected the idea. And after his triumphant performance that night, he felt no need to enter the spin room, understanding that his victory over the enfeebled president was so comprehensive that he could sit back and watch the press tear Mr. Biden apart. His aggressive spinning on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning appeared to be an unspoken acknowledgement that his performance was suboptimal." This word is being used a lot in regards to the president's debate, former president's debate performance. The day after Mr. Trump's debate with Ms. Harris, his aides and his allies were largely echoing his praise of his performance in public, but privately conceding that the former president had a rough outing in stark contrast to his more controlled appearance against Mr. Biden. An exception was the recent Trump endorser, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Vice President Harris clearly won the debate in terms of her delivery, her polish, her organization, and her preparation, Mr. Kennedy said on Fox News on Wednesday, adding that while Mr. Trump wins on substance, he didn't tell that story. Ira, what do you think?
Well, this is like a grab bag. There's so many places we can go with this. I'll leave the others to talk more about the substance of the debate. And, I mean, clearly, in my view, Harris mopped the floor with him. And the fact that Trump is trying to say otherwise once again shows what I've been talking about for a long time, that the people who think MAGA people are stupid are not the Democrats, but it's the people like Trump who plays them for suckers and has a debate such as the one he just had and then comes out and said, "We did great. It's the best one I ever had." I mean, it's just nonsense. What I was particularly interested in, and we may wind up talking about this more on the media show, which is we're going to tape after this, but the way it was moderated, the fact-checking or lack thereof, the follow-ups or lack thereof, I'm really torn about it. One being the fact-checking, where three or four times David Muir broke in and said, "No, you say it's this way, but it's that way."
They're not eating dogs in Springfield.
Yeah, and it generally has been favorably received at them having done that. I'm of the mind, although I can be convinced otherwise, that those fact checks in a debate setting should have been offered up by the opponent of the person who said the original error. I mean, it's a part of the debate. If you say tomorrow is Monday, there shouldn't be a moderator saying, "No, it's tomorrow is Tuesday." That should be the participant saying it, in my view. So there's that. And then the other thing was I felt, by the way, generally speaking, I thought that moderators did very well, but so I'm picking on them and small stuff. I get disappointed when they ask a question and the participant doesn't answer the question and just goes on and whatever the subject he or she wants to catch up on.
Right.
And I think it when that occurs, even after having given them the time to say whatever they want, the moderator should say, but you didn't answer my question, and pin them down on that.
David Muir, well, they both were very good at that, I thought, in the sense of they would say, okay, but the subject is Afghanistan. And,
yeah.
Okay, you're you're talking not about that. So, but the subject is, and they would try, and I think it was easier to bring Kamala Harris back into the
Well, one of the downsides would have been is if Trump, for example, doesn't answer the question, then goes on and uses his 2 minutes to talk about something else, and then you say you didn't answer my question, then he winds up getting more time than he should get.
Which he did.
He wound up getting about 5 minutes more.
Nick.
I just wanted to say I think Trump is correct. It probably was one of his best debates, right? He did not fly off the handle too often. He did in some from some people's perspectives win, I guess, certain points. Some people were very happy with his answers on things like, actually, some people were happy with his answers on Ukraine, believe it or not. Some people were happy on his answers on the economy. He got, I think, tripped up on what he should have come out stronger on with his voters on immigration, because Harris is quite skilled, it turns out, at goading him into chaos, I guess. But he did do pretty well for a Trump debate. I guess that says a lot.
Yeah. JP?
I obviously think he did poorly. And I don't think he necessarily did well in the first debate with Biden. It's just he was next to Biden, who did so poorly that the focus was not on Trump and his answers. I think it's a real big question as to whether he will debate again. I think his advisors are likely convinced that he is incapable of turning in a debate different than he did the other night. I think Republicans in general, a lot of friends that I talk to who I know are Trump voters, are frustrated, who say, how could he not prosecute a cogent policy argument against Vice President Harris, where there are such big differences in the country on immigration, on the economy, on health care, on abortion, on all these issues. And an example of that is, you know, you're arguing about abortion and he continues to say, well, they allow abortions after the baby's born. There's people executing babies. And it's just on its face ridiculous, you know, and he does that over and over on every single topic. On immigration, there's a reasonable case to be made that maybe the country should have a different immigration policy than what's been happening over the last 3.5 years, but he is incapable of prosecuting any of those arguments. I think that we will not know whether there's going to be another debate until about 10 days from today, and that's when the swing state polls will be taken, where they take into account not just the people that watch the debate. Watching the debate is important, but also the 2 to 3 to 4 days after the debate, where we're all on the radio talking about it, everybody's on the TV talking about it, we're reading it, and the debate performances are digested by the American people, and we will see whether there is movement in the swing state polls, where almost all of them, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, you look at Real Clear Politics, they're all within a point and a half in all of those polls. And so I think Vice President Harris is excited to debate again. She didn't come close to making a single mistake. Her closing argument was one of the most well-practiced, well-thought-out, perfectly delivered. People say, oh, she memorized it. Well, yeah, that's the point. You prepare for a debate, you have your closing statement memorized, and you put together a clear thing that you want the American people to view. This is why you're going to vote for me. And so she's excited to debate again. I don't know whether you will get Trump to agree to another one, because he can't do better than what we saw the other night, in my opinion.
Well, he wants, if he were to do another debate, he would want Fox to do it, and he's already denouncing the would-be moderators on Fox. So I think he's laying the groundwork to say, no, I don't want to do it. I can't get a fair break even at Fox. I'm surprised that Harris, I guess Harris is, with justification, really hyped about how well she did, because she does apparently want a second debate. And one of the things Trump said that was accurate is usually the person who loses the first debate wants the second debate. And she doesn't really need another debate, I don't think. It would be risky. She can't do much better than she just did.
Well, I do think she needs more time and more opportunity to show people greater detail on some of the issues she didn't get to talk as much about, and to kind of share a little bit more about who she is as, like, a human being. I think those are the two things that responses that we've heard from the debate that people want to know who she is. So there is some value in going on stage again and having another debate and taking another opportunity, particularly because Trump did get significantly more time to speak and respond to questions than she did in this debate. And I do think she could get him to, if she poked that bear enough, right? If she kind of dangled like a carrot in front of him. I think he's a little, you know, he's kind of childish, maybe, and and she clearly has the upper hand in that way. And I think there's lots of reasons for why. I think, you know, he is a misogynist, he is narcissistic, and I think it drives him nuts that she is as competitive in this race as he is, where he clearly believes that he is, like, far superior to, like, anything Harris could provide to the country. So I think there is some value for her. And also, I think if she plays her cards right, she could get him to do it.
If my memory is right, and I can guarantee you it may not be right, but when the debates were run by the debate commission,
it's a steel trap,
and they had more than one debate planned ahead of time, two and I think occasionally three.
Yes.
Each of the debates had a theme. So in other words, you'd have a domestic debate, you'd have an international debate, and I don't know what the third one was.
It was like foreign policy, and then.
So the question to consider is, if they were to have another debate, and only one other, because it doesn't seem likely, if they have a second one, they won't have a third one. Would the second one be similar in the topics to what we just heard? And in that case, what can be gleaned when we've already had that debate? Or is there going to be an onus on the moderators to come up with a whole new bunch of subjects, which may or may not be a good idea? But the whole structure has fallen apart because Trump didn't want to take part with the commission.
With a commission of on debates and which has overseen debates for decades, it will be interesting to see exactly if they come up with anything. We are also we should mention that there is going to be a vice presidential debate, and that is in October. It's not that far away. It's going to be between Tim Walz and J.D. Vance, and I don't. In my opinion, like, they've never meant a whole lot. I mean, they're important, but they're more of sideshow than the real, than the two candidates going after each other. Sometimes they can have some good viral moments. The Fly. But
Dan Quayle moment.
That's the Dan Quayle moment. Yeah. But still, you know, how much are they is gonna come out of that? And for either campaign, is it going to propel people to change their mind if their mind has not already been made up?
Yeah, the vice presidential debate, I think you will see both J.D. Vance and Tim Walz are both polished politicians who will both turn in, I think, reasonably good debate performance. It's hard to imagine one or the other really dominating. But going back to another presidential debate, it's interesting you brought, I was also thinking, Ira, about the Presidential Debate Commission and how those debates, some were standing up in the round and questions asked by the audience members. You saw, you know, the candidates, just them walking around the stage was certainly stagecraft and stuff that voters took into account as they watched them interact with each other and shake hands and you know, take on the different topics. And it's I'm surprised that any debates get agreed to, because the campaigns used to have no input. They would, the debate commission would say, here are the three debates, here are the dates, here are the locations, here are the topics. They would they would dictate it to the campaigns. The campaigns would have no input as to what the, and having the Harris campaign and the Trump campaign negotiate another debate, I think it's hard to believe it gets pulled off, even though I think Harris, even though she won that first debate, she wants another one. These swing state polls, I think that you will see her gain in the swing state polls in 10 days, but I don't think it's going to be, in 10 days, we're all going to think it's a wipeout. She has work to do to win. And I think that the debate, better, she would rather debate Trump than do an interview with a mainstream media outlet, because it's going to be a better venue for her. You know, she's going to perform better against Trump than she would against George Stephanopoulos or a reporter.
Which I still don't quite understand. I don't understand the reluctance of doing that. Of doing a sit-down major interview, whether it be 60 Minutes or Christiane Amanpour or somebody, and doing because she certainly showed she's great in that setting. Just do the same. It's the same skill set. You know what you want to say, and you do it. I don't understand. I thought the interview that they did on ABC, or it was CNN with Dana Bash, right, where the two of them were together, it was fine, but it wasn't. I don't know what they necessarily gained out of it, and I do think doing it together was probably a mistake.
Well, I think I'm confident that she will do any number of interviews. 60 Minutes is an obvious one, but I'm sure she will. A, because she must, and B, because I think she's up to it. I believe that she very wisely took the path that she took when Biden dropped out and ramped up her own candidacy and did all the right things and was not encumbered by a major interview. And I'm certain that she will have them. The public is going to demand it, and she will adhere to it.
JP?
I imagine she will do more interviews, although she walks a delicate rope in terms of how she has evolved on some key issues, and that is obviously what the journalists are going to focus on. 4 years ago, you were for this fracking and et cetera, you're against fracking, whatever. All, you know, the position she took during the 2020 nomination when she was trying to run to the left of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and those positions, she's obviously evolved. Now, she knows that every vote that she needs to win is a middle-of-the-road voter who is thinking in their mind that they may vote for Donald Trump or they may vote for Kamala Harris. There are those people out there, and those are the people that are going to determine the election. And so they have to think very carefully what interviews she does with what outlets and how she's going to continue to answer those questions. Where the journalists are going to prosecute the case against her better than Trump. Trump did a very poor job prosecuting the case against Kamala Harris the other night. If she's across from Christiane Amanpour or George Stephanopoulos, she could get into a little bit of a situation where she's not perfectly on message.
I've said all along, I think it was a smart move for her to avoid interviews while she developed her platform, redefined who she is as a candidate, and distanced herself from Biden so that she could have kind of her own race. I thought that was clever, and I said that the other night. But going forward, being open to interviews, she has this risk of the so-called undecided voters, which, you know, some people are not sure exist, or the people who she could galvanize and actually get out to vote. And those, the people who are going to stay home unless they're really enthusiastic, are going to come out to vote on a more progressive issues. And the people that are considered moderate or are swing votes are coming, she would have to appeal to them on a more moderate level. And those things are really in conflict with each other. And I think it makes it really difficult for her to have very specific responses to very complicated issues.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 12th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel The Week in Review. On Friday, September 13th, Sarah LeDuc was in for Joe Donahue, and she was joined by Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Public Policy and Communications Expert Teresa Bourgeois, and former EPA Regional Administrator, President of Beyond Plastics, and faculty member at Bennington College, Judith Enk.
All right, let us get down to it. On Wednesday, Beyond Plastics expressed hope that the next U.S. president is up for the challenge of reversing course on the annual plastic pollution that is currently projected to nearly double by 2040. The organization released a 27-point agenda to guide the winner of the November election. And speaking of presidents, the president of Beyond Plastics is our regular panelist, Judith Enk. She's, of course, here this morning, as we've just introduced her. And we would like you, Judith, to tell us about this proposed agenda. How'd you all put it together? What are we focusing on? What does it mean?
Oh, sure thing. Thanks, Sarah. So, you know, the thing about the plastics issue is it can get a little overwhelming at times, and people get a little despondent. I don't, because I know that there are solutions. But it's a serious issue that really warrants federal attention. We're turning our ocean into a landfill, filling it up with plastic. Scientists tell us that by 2050, unless we change the status quo, there'll be more plastic in the ocean than fish. Plastic production is contributing to climate change because of the greenhouse gas emissions and the toxic emissions from making plastic. And interestingly, almost every few months, there's a major new study identifying the presence of microplastics or nanoplastics in different parts of our body. Microplastics has been found in our blood, in our lungs, in the human placenta, in breast milk, in male testicles. Last March, New England Journal of Medicine published a report that found microplastics in arteries heading to our hearts. It attaches to plaque. And this New England Journal of Medical study, co-authored by over 40 researchers, said that the presence of the plastics in the heart arteries is contributing to stroke, heart attack, and premature death. Now, there's an incredible policy disconnect between what the science is telling us and what policymakers are doing to address the problem. So we know that there's going to be a new president in January, whoever she or he is. So we took the liberty of preparing a to-do list for the new president, and we shared it with both the Trump campaign and the Harris campaign, and various people in Washington. And we quickly came up with 27 policy recommendations. Just a few is we urge a new president to adopt a national packaging reduction bill that would require a reduction in single-use plastic packaging and required to get toxics out of packaging. There's a wonderful state bill passed by the New York State Senate and pending in the Assembly that would do just that. So let's take that New York idea, not a law yet, but we hope it will be next year, and you know, address it nationally. We advocate for a national bottle bill. New Yorkers know how to deal with deposits on beverage containers. Only 10 states have bottle bills. It's time for a national bottle bill. We call for an increase in testing, monitoring, and cleanup of the environment around communities, in communities where petrochemical facilities are operating. There's a 80-mile stretch along the Mississippi River in Louisiana called Cancer Alley, where there is a concentration of petrochemical facilities, a lot of it to make plastic, and where people are suffering with elevated cancer rates and respiratory problems. And then the final one I'll mention is there is a United Nations negotiation going on right now to adopt an international treaty on plastics. And many countries have joined together in something called the High Ambition Coalition to end plastic pollution. And that is a very vibrant effort where countries are coming together to support specific policies with deadlines to reduce plastics. And the United States is not part of it. The United States is not playing a particularly productive role in these treaty negotiations. So we have recommendations on that. And then finally, we support what's called a just transition for plastic production workers. You know, we have to be honest. If we're going to make less plastic, people working in that sector will have fewer jobs, but they can transition to working with other materials. There are alternatives to plastic. So we are hosting a free educational webinar on October 1st at 7 p.m. We have an all-star panel, a woman named Jo Banner with the Descendants Project who lives in Cancer Alley in Louisiana, Dr. Sam Mason, who is an expert on microplastics in freshwater, Kevin Boudris with Just Zero, my colleague at Beyond Plastics, Jessica Conard, who lives in East Palestine, Ohio, and who has been very active on that terrible toxic train derailment, and myself. So if folks want to dig a little deeper with us, join us on October 1st. All the information is at beyondplastics.org. But the long and short of it is, when we get a new president, if they are serious about reducing plastic pollution, there's a lot they can do. And we know that there is bipartisan support for reducing plastic pollution. I often, believe it or not, still meet people who are climate change deniers. I love it when people ask me, do you believe in climate change? Like it's theological or something. But I've never met a plastic pollution denier, because you walk down any city street, you go to any park, you go to the beach, you look up, you see plastic bags in the tree branches. You know, the evidence is everywhere. But the lack of action by the federal government is really worrisome, and we hope we're going to turn a page on this in January.
The free webinar is on October 1st at 7 p.m. You can learn more at beyondplastics.org. To learn more about the agenda, there is an article at commondreams.org if you'd like to read more about the Beyond Plastics proposed agenda for the next presidential administration. Teresa, Heather, or Fran, do you have any questions or comments regarding this topic for Judith?
I have one comment and a question for Judith, who I just so love her expertise and understanding this. And my comment is, some time ago, this is Fran, I was on the board of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, which was super interesting. And, of course, we had our meetings on the Pacific Ocean, which was wonderful.
That's very cool.
And, yeah, it was very cool. And some of the researchers there were actually studying plastics in the ocean. So it's not just, you know, humans that are being harmed by this. There was an amazing amount of microplastics in the ocean, and this researcher was really trying to measure that and measure the impact on sea life. And her results showed that it was just striking how bad it's getting and how fast the increase is. And I don't quite remember the numbers, but I just remember just being wowed in a negative way by all of this. So Judith and her colleagues are doing the good work, and I think it's so important. So here's my question for Judith. Mm-hmm. So Judith, it's pretty compelling stuff. Why isn't this a nonpartisan issue? I mean, why doesn't everybody think, yeah, this is an important thing to do, and yeah, we got to figure out what the economics of it is, but it's worth doing?
It really is, and I love your plug for Monterey Bay Aquarium. Many of the aquariums around the country are working on the plastics issues now. My final month in the Obama administration, I was invited to give a keynote speech there where they were organizing a bunch of the aquariums together, and I have to confess, I was the first speaker at the conference. I did moderately okay, you know, whatever. And then I kept playing hooky and going over to the aquarium because it was right next door.
Yeah.
And it was like the best trip.
It's gobsmacking. It's fantastic.
The Monterey Bay Aquarium is a national treasure. It's so, so great.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're ever out there, you have to go and you have to like budget a lot of time and not just play hooky at a conference. To your question, Fran, I think there's just this horrible disconnect between science and political science. And when we propose the most modest policies to reduce plastic, it is met by vigorous opposition by the plastics industry, the chemical industry, and the fossil fuel industry, the triumvirate. So on a certain level, it's even harder than working on climate change, as hard as that is. Because you've got the fossil fuel opponents and plastic makers they don't want to make less plastic. So, you know, getting the plastic the ban law adopted in New York took years and then was challenged in court. And then the DEC screwed up the regulations. And then finally, you know, you go to the store in New York and most people bring their own reusable bags. It's not that hard, but it took years to get that adopted. So it's just due to the ferocious opposition of special interests that we're not seeing progress. And these new medical studies showing the presence of microplastics in our bodies really should be a clarion call for action. And what we hear from the plastics industry, they don't dispute that we have microplastics in our blood and our lungs and our organs, but they say, oh, there's no evidence that it causes harm. And that is the next frontier of health research. But I don't know about you. I prefer not to have little fragments of plastics in my lungs and my heart arteries. Just saying.
Teresa Bourgeois.
Thank you, Judith. I realized I didn't have much of an understanding of where the Biden-Harris administration were on plastics, so I did a little research and found the Environmental Health News did a piece saying the Harris administration could make significant strides against plastic pollution, leveraging her, and I'm quoting here, background as a California Attorney General and support for federal legislation aimed at reducing plastic waste. And they talk about how she has a strong environmental record, co-sponsored the Break Free from Plastics Pollution Act in 2020. As VP, she supported initiatives to eliminate single-use plastics from federal operations, et cetera. And they talk about the recent administration at the end of July. I guess you know more about this than me.
Mm-hmm.
But they basically using the power of the federal government, purchasing power, to try to reduce plastics. But I think of that in comparison to the Trump Supreme Court and the recent ruling on potential changes on regulatory actions that are going to really weaken regulatory power. And looking at a lot of your proposals, they depend on the regulatory authority of the federal government. And so what are your thoughts on that, Judith, on the regulatory, you know, if you weaken the ability of the administration for their regulatory authority ability, that really cuts into what seems like a lot of the,
yes.
a lot on your list.
Yes, it is a major problem. Teresa, you're referring to the Chevron decision
right.
by the Supreme Court that says you no longer defer to federal agencies like the EPA, like the Food and Drug Administration, like the Health and Human Services agencies. I'm still kind of in shock months later on this Chevron decision. It is going to have, regardless of who is president, it's going to have a pretty devastating impact because EPA is sued more than any other federal agency, sued by the environmental community, sued by companies, sued by states. So the Chevron decision is going to be a major problem, and the remedy is Congress adopting very, very specific, more detailed statutes and not just saying, okay, plastic pollution is a problem. We want EPA to do ABC. EPA, you go figure it out. I think those days of lawmaking at the federal level are gone if a sponsor is serious about resolving the problem. And there, you know, there is a difference between the candidates. I'm glad you recited some of Harris's pledges, including when she was attorney general, holding fossil fuel companies accountable. It'll be interesting. You know, some state AGs are starting to take action. New York Attorney General Tish James sued Pepsi, which for their plastic pollution in the Buffalo River watershed, which I thought was a pretty gutsy thing to do, given that the headquarters of Pepsi is in Westchester County. Go Tish James. So you're starting to see not really tobacco industry-style lawsuits, but you're seeing some pretty interesting lawsuits from state attorneys general, you know, and that's certainly the lane that Harris is in. I'm also very, very amused by candidate Trump's focus on plastic straws.
Right.
The first day that it was announced that President Biden was not going to seek re-election and he endorsed Kamala Harris, one of the first issues on that first day that Trump talked about was that Harris supported a ban on plastic straws. And it's come up a couple times, and I just find it rather amusing.
That was Judith Enck on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 13th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. On Thursday, September 19th, Joe Donahue will host 5 expert panelists for a discussion of diversity, equity, and inclusion in front of a live studio audience at the Linda in Albany, New York. Learn more at wamc.org. And on Monday, September 16th, Malcolm Nance and guests will be on a Locked Box Roundtable panel special focused on the conflict in Ukraine. That will be live on air from 9 to 11 a.m. on Monday. The WAMC Locked Box is open, and anything you can give now helps shorten our on-air fund drive. You may pledge anytime at wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.